the forceps, he managed to extract a deformed metallic object from the wall behind her.
"Ball bearing?" she asked.
Harvath shook his head.
"It looks like lead. I think it's supposed to be a musket ball."
Cordero closed her eyes and shook her head.
"How many dead?"
10, 20? I can't tell. Whatever it is, there's scores more wounded. Are you okay, though?"
She looked at the EMT, who nodded and said, "She's going to be fine." Cordero then looked at Harvath.
"All the macho bullshit aside, are you sure you're okay?"
Harvath looked at the EMT, who shrugged and said, "You got your lights turned out. You should let us transport you to the hospital so you can get a full workup."
"Not really a big fan of hospitals," he replied.
"You took a good blow to your head," the EMT stated. "I'm not kidding. You really should let us take you in."
"Not going to happen."
"Sir, how many fingers am I holding up?" Harvath forced a smile and held up his fist.
"Now, how many fingers am I holding up?"
Cordero shook her head. "It's up to you," the EMT said. "I can't force you to go." Harvath looked around. The devastation was amazing.
And here we were so sure it was going to be a sniper.
"We were half right," she replied,
picking up the forceps with the deformed lead ball.
"How many of these things do you think were packed in that suicide vest? Hundreds? Thousands?"
Harvath had no idea.
"Almost done?"
he asked the EMT.
"Just about," the man responded, as he affixed the gauze over Harvath's left eyebrow and taped it in place.
"Now we're done." He thanked the man, and after he and Cordero signed off on paperwork, refusing to be transported to the hospital for further evaluation, the EMT stood up and moved on to treat other people.
"Now what?"
Cordero asked.
"Pretty serious crime scene. Multiple homicides. I'd imagine you want to investigate."
"No,"
she said, looking at how filthy she was.
"You know what I want? I want to change my clothes, hug my son, and have a drink."
He understood how she felt. They were both in shock.
"You want company?"
he asked.
Cordero looked at him.
"For the have a drink part."
He didn't need to clarify his remark. She knew what he meant.
"I'd like that," she replied.
Harvath helped her to her feet, and they leaned against each other for a moment. It felt good. It also felt wrong. They shouldn't be going for a drink. They should be working this crime scene, trying to find clues, something that would lead them to who had done this so that they could prevent any further deaths. He also knew that this entire investigation had gone to a completely new level. This was beyond a homicide investigation now. This was going to be classified as terrorism. Boston PD, the FBI, ATF, DHS, all the alphabets in the soup were going to be involved. They would comb every square millimeter of space looking for clues, and they would bring to bear the most sophisticated technology available. This wasn't the place for them now. If something broke, they'd be notified. Besides, after what they had just been through, cheating death like that, they needed some downtime. Nevertheless, Harvath felt guilty about leaving. Cordero seemed to be able to read his thoughts.
"This wasn't our fault," she said.
She was right, but it didn't change the way he felt. This was the first time that they had been ahead of the killers, but it hadn't made any difference. It hadn't stopped anything. There were even more people dead now. They walked in silence, showing their credentials when they had to duck under crime scene tape to get out of the blast area. Just past where Betsy Mitchell had been detonated, they stopped at one of the corpses. It had been covered with a plastic tarp. Cordero leaned over and pulled it back. It was a mass of cloth and bloody flesh. There was no human form to it at all. The man had been so close when the explosion happened. The only possible means of identifying him was the half-melted nameplate that still read, Kaczynski. Cordero lowered the tarp.
"He was a good cop," she said, her voice heavy with emotion. "A really good cop.
We're going to get the people who did this. I promise you."
She turned and faced him.
"How can you promise something like that?"
"You wanted to know what I do? What I really do? That's what I do. I get people. And I promise you, I will get the people who did this.
Chapter 63. Harvath's clothes were filthy. There were bits and pieces of things on them that neither he nor Cordero wanted to identify. They spent 20 minutes looking for Sal, hoping they could grab some of the extra clothing he had in his vehicle. His cell phone was off, and he wasn't responding to any calls over the radio. They figured he was either with the head of the homicide unit, or more than likely debriefing with the FBI. It wasn't a big deal. At least, Cordero knew he was okay. His had been the first face she had seen after the explosion. In the chaos, he had helped her to her feet and then helped get her to a safe area. He had even found the EMT for her before she had sent him back to find Harvath. When they got to her car, Harvath asked her if she was okay to drive. She nodded.
I guess if you want to drop me at my hotel, he said, I'll change into my old clothes there.
I have clothes I think will fit you, she replied. That is, if you don't think it's too weird.
No, I don't think it would be too weird at all.
At any other time, Harvath would have turned her invitation into a joke about an offer to wear her clothing, but he knew that wasn't what she was inviting him to do. It was an incredibly vulnerable moment for her, and he treated it and her with all the respect that it deserved. They drove through the Boston streets in silence. There wasn't much to say, not after what had just happened. It was a goofy analogy, but as they got closer and closer to her house, Cordero was like a knight letting one piece of armor fall away at a time. You could almost hear them clanking onto the asphalt and receding behind them as they drove. As each piece fell, she softened, and Harvath saw a different side of her, something he hadn't even noticed over wine at dinner. The take-no-prisoners cop was sexy, but the woman beneath was even more so. It was like watching her turn into a completely different person, which was exactly what was happening. She was shifting into becoming a mother, a daughter, and simply a person. The transformation was captivating. It was a depth he had never really appreciated in the women he had known before. They arrived at her home, and she parked her car in the garage. It was an attractive three-flat, made from heavy blocks of stone.
Is this whole place yours? He asked.
Cordero nodded.
The whole building's mine. I rent out the ground floor unit. Marco and I are on the second floor, and then my parents have the top.
Who's watching Marco now?
I'm guessing it's my mom. Dad has probably already gone to bed.
She checked the mail on her way in, and then led Harvath up to the second floor. Just inside the front door, there was a closet with a small gun safe. Unloading her primary and backup weapons, she tucked them inside, along with her cuffs, her badge, and her credentials.
You don't keep something next to the bed? He asked.
I absolutely do, the detective replied. Just not this one.
Racking a 12-gauge shotgun sounds a lot more intimidating than racking a Glock.
Harvath smiled. He liked her, more than just a little bit. The female detective smiled back and led him into the living room where her mother was watching TV. She made the introductions in English and then spoke to her mother for a few moments in Portuguese. He had no idea what they were talking about, but assumed by the look on the older woman's face that she was giving her a quick rundown on everything that had happened. She seemed like the type who would try to spare her mother any unnecessary worry, and had probably watered down a lot of what had transpired. At the end, both women had looked at Harvath, and the mother had appeared impressed. He couldn't tell why. He figured Cordero had told her how he had knocked her to the ground and thrown himself on top of her to protect her from the blast. The female detective showed him down the hallway to the guest room.
The guest bathroom is through that door, she said. There's fresh towels in there. You can help yourself to anything you need. I'll grab some clothes and leave them here on the bed for you.
Thank you, said Harvath.
She lingered in the doorway.
You're welcome.
He smiled again.
I saw that look on your mother's face.
What look?
At the end, when you were telling her what happened with the explosion and everything, how I knocked you to the ground. You didn't have to tell her that.
Cordero laughed.
Don't flatter yourself. I didn't.
What?
She asked me where you grew up. I told her Southern California. She said you look like a surfer. I told her that was impossible.
Why is that impossible?
Because you never learned how to swim.
She was playing with him, and he liked it.
There's a neighborhood place around the corner that stays open late, she added. We can get a drink and something to eat there.
What about Marco? He asked.
My mother will stay. Now, hurry up and take a shower. I'm getting hungry.
Cordero really put the guest in guest bathroom. There were razors, mouthwash, combs, everything he could possibly need. After taking a quick shower and grabbing a shave, he stepped out of the bathroom to find she had left clothes on the bed for him as promised. For the most part, it all fit pretty well. After getting dressed, he threaded his holster through his belt, double-checked his weapon, and then put on the jacket she had picked for him. He looked at himself in the bathroom mirror. He thought his pistol would print through the material, but it didn't. All in all, she had done very well. He transferred the contents of his pockets into the clothes he was now wearing, exited the guest room, and walked up to the front of the apartment. He made small talk with the detective's mother until Lara emerged from her room wearing jeans, boots, and a very flattering top. Her hair was pulled back in a ponytail, and she had gone light on the makeup, focusing mostly on a shade of lipstick that drew attention to her attractive full lips.
It all fits, she said. You look good.
Thank you. So do you.
Are we ready to go?
What about that hug for your son?
Cordero smiled.
I gave him one while you were in the shower, but I do want to kiss him goodbye. Why don't you come with me?
Sure. I'd love to.
Harvath followed her down the hall, past the guest room to a small room off the master bedroom. With enormous stuffed bears, airplanes suspended from the ceiling, and bright blue walls, it was the perfect little boy's room. And asleep in his race car bed, complete with rails that made sure he didn't fall out, was the perfect little boy. Marco had sandy blonde hair and was tan like his mother. He had cheeks that probably got pinched a lot. He looked so peaceful, so unaware of what had happened in the world tonight. It was the way it should be. Harbath was immediately taken by the little guy. He was even cuter than the photo Cordero had shown him. As she walked in to kiss her son, Harvath's eyes scanned the shelves above the little boy's bed. There were lots of great children's books, a bunch of stuffed animals, several Fisher-Price vehicles, and something that stopped Harvath's heart cold. Cordero spotted the look on his face instantly.
What is it? She asked. What's wrong?
Harvath leaned over the bed and grabbed the object off the shelf.
Where did you get this?
It's just an airplane. Why?
Lara, where did this come from?
He demanded, as his other hand began to reach for his gun.
It was a gift from Sal. What's this all about?
Placing the detailed display model of the Ariane supersonic business jet back on the shelf, Harbath said,
I'll explain in the car, but we need to move. Now.
Chapter 64. They had argued the entire above-the-speed-limit drive to Sal Sabatini's home. No matter how strenuously she defended him, though, Harbath knew she was entertaining the possibility. Over their years together, she had seen something, perhaps even several things, that either she had chosen to ignore or that hadn't made sense until this evening. The bottom line was that she was cooperating, and that was the most important thing at this point. Coming to grips with it was something he could help her with later. As he stood in the backyard and peered through the kitchen window, he could hear the phone ringing inside. After dialing the number a second time and letting it ring, Harvath signaled for Cordero to put her phone away. Sal was home and waiting for this to happen, in which case Harvath regretted showing up without the SWAT team, or he'd already offed himself, or maybe was someplace else entirely, preparing to kill the remaining hostage. Having looked in the garage and finding it empty, he figured Sal was dead or someplace else. That said, he had fooled a lot of people for a long time and had been exceptionally well-trained. For all Harvath knew,
He could have parked his car around the corner to give anyone considering entry a false sense of security. Harvath's mind was doing flips, trying to sort out all the possibilities. There was only one way to approach this: prepare for the worst and hope for the best. With his weapon out and ready, he said to Cordero,
"Good to go?"
She nodded and removed her picks from the lock. He hadn't seen any signs that the house had an alarm system. That was the funny thing about cops. Some were extremely security conscious, while there were others who were incredibly lax. Sal Sabatini, though, was also nuts, so who knew what his deal was? Harvath counted in a whisper, backward.
3, 2, 1.
On one, she turned the handle and quietly pushed the door open so Harvath could slip inside. The kitchen was 30 years out of date, but clean, and smelled faintly of spices. There was a door to the basement, and Harvath made a quick command decision. They'd save that for last. Grabbing one of the vinyl-backed lime-green kitchen chairs, he tucked it under the knob and made sure the door was securely closed. If Sal or anyone else was hiding down there and tried to come back up, they were going to make quite a ruckus trying to get out. With Cordero covering his 6 o'clock, Harvath swept in and cleared the dining room, living room, and the front hall closet. Next were the bedrooms, which he hated almost as much as basements. The tiny bungalow-style dwelling only had 2 bedrooms, which were clear. There was no one in the closets or under the beds. The bathrooms were also clear, as was a tiny attic space above that they accessed from a set of pull-down stairs. That just left the basement. Lord, how he hated basements. Weighing the odds that there might be a teachable, "I told you so" moment in the kitchen, he opened the freezer, but it was devoid of severed heads or any other body parts. Time to face the real music. Cordero put her hand on his arm this time.
"I'll do it," she said.
Removing the chair from underneath the doorknob, she flicked on the lights and waited. Nothing. She then did something Harvath hadn't thought of. Noticing there were no risers, she lay down on her stomach and peered between the first and second stair. After that, she used her flashlight to illuminate the far corners. Satisfied, she stood up and went down to clear the basement. 2 minutes later, she was back in the kitchen.
"Nothing," she said. "Nothing at all. Everything must have taken place via that warehouse. I'll bet he's the one that tipped them to clear out before we hit it."
Cordero didn't comment. She was still having trouble wrapping her mind around everything. She felt guilty and disloyal, doubly so by agreeing to accompany Harvath and break into her partner's home.
"Why don't we see what else is here?" he said,
heading back toward the living room, a small corner of which had been set up with a desk and appeared to function as the man's home office. Sal was meticulous. There were records and receipts for everything. Just nothing attaching him to anything illegal. While Harvath had hoped against hope that there would be something here, he wasn't surprised. A detective would hopefully be much too smart to leave anything directly tying himself to a crime. Harvath powered on the computer and waited for it to boot up. Once it did, he was greeted with a password screen.
"Try Red Sox Fan 7, Cordero said from behind him. "All caps, all one word. That's what he uses at the office."
Harvath entered the password and was granted access.
"It worked," he said. "I'm sure after all these years he knows mine, too."
"What is it?"
"None of your business," she replied.
"All caps? All one word?"
he said, as he tried to pull up Sal Sabatini's recent web browsing history. There was nothing there. It had all been scrubbed. There was nothing in his email history either, though he doubted that was how Sal conducted clandestine communications. He would have received better training than that. Harvath looked at his Word documents as well as his iTunes folders. It was all very pedestrian and boring, right down to the wallpaper on his desktop. It looked like Sal had chosen the factory default, which was a little odd, as Harvath didn't know anyone who didn't monkey around with their desktop, at least a little bit, to try to make it more personal. Going into the settings area, he opened the folder that held sample photos for the desktop. They were typical stock landscape shots. He then clicked over to the screensaver folder, and that's when he saw it. Cordero was looking through some of Sal's books on the other side of the living room.
"You're going to want to see this," Harbath said. "Recognize this young lady?"
There were a series of shots of a goth-type woman posing around headstones at the granary burying ground.
"That's Brittany Doyle, the one you paid $400 to for her bracelet cuff, from which we got a full and a partial print. But if those were Sal's prints, why didn't we get a hit on them?"
"Because whatever prints the Boston PD has on file for Detective Sal Sabatini, they don't belong to Sal Sabatini."
She was about to ask who was capable of making prints disappear from the Boston PD database when her cell phone vibrated in her back pocket. Looking at the caller ID, she froze.
"Who is it?" Harbath asked.
Cordero held the phone up so Harbath could see.
"It's him. Sal."
Chapter 65. Cordero activated the call and waited. She didn't know what to say. How do you greet the man you've just learned is a cold-blooded killer? As it turned out, she didn't have to say anything. He started the conversation himself.
"I'm sorry to have to do this over the phone," he said. "What are you talking about, Sal? Where are you?" she asked.
In the background, she could hear what sounded like noises from the harbor.
"I wanted to say goodbye to you and Marco in person." "Goodbye? Why? Where are you going, Sal?"
"Lara, I know you're in my house. That means you must know everything."
Cordero covered the phone's mic and quickly whispered to Harbath,
"He knows we're here. We need to get out. There could be a bomb. Keep him talking." "Tell me why you did it, Sal," she said,
as they moved out of the living room and through the dining room.
"Why did you kill all those people?"
"You weren't supposed to be hurt," the man replied. "I love you and Marco very much, and I'm very angry about what happened tonight. You could have been killed."
"You act like you didn't know it was going to happen, Sal."
"I didn't. Betsy Mitchell was not my responsibility."
"Whose responsibility was she then, Sal?"
"Don't worry. I'll take care of it."
"Sal," Cordero said firmly, "what do you mean you'll take care of it? What are you taking care of?"
The man was silent on the other end of the phone as Harbath and Cordero rushed out the kitchen door and into the backyard.
"Sal," she demanded, "where's the last hostage? Tell me. You can still make this right. Where's Jonathan Renner?"
Finally, Cordero removed the phone from her ear.
"Where's Renner?" Harbath asked. "Did he tell you?" "No. He just hung up." "Damn it." "He said he was angry about what happened tonight, that I could have been hurt. He wanted me to know that Betsy Mitchell had not been his responsibility."
"What does that mean?"
"I think somebody else was responsible for killing her," she replied.
"Maybe suicide vests are someone else's job. He didn't deny killing the other victims, though, did he?"
"No, he didn't."
"We've got to find him. Where would he go for safety? Where do you think he'd try to hide?"
"I could hear ambient noise behind him," she said. "I think he was at the harbor."
"Is he running? Was he catching the ferry for Logan Airport?"
"He said he was going to take care of the danger I was put in tonight. It sounded to me like he was going to take care of the person who put me in danger."
"Did he say anything else?"
"I don't know," Cordero replied. "After that, he hung up."
"He must have had some sort of monitoring system on his house or his computer that alerted his phone when we came in. He's blown, and he knows it. We need to get to the harbor as fast as possible."
"He could be anywhere."
"I don't think so,"
Harbath stated, as he led her down the driveway and back toward where they had parked her car.
"I think they're out of time, and they're pulling out all the stops. They're going to kill Renner tonight, too."
"But where?"
"What's the last significant historical event that also happens to take place at the harbor?"
Cordero stopped as she realized what it was.
"The Boston Tea Party."
The pieces were all coming together for her and made so much sense now. How the killer had been able to avoid being picked up on any CCTV cameras. How he'd not left any clues behind at the crime scenes. Even the crazy contraption at the Liberty Tree site, as Sal had studied engineering in school before switching to criminology and had remained fascinated by it. But for every piece that fell into place, it came attached to 1,000 questions. Harvath had explained what swim club was and even how they may have recruited Sal. But Cordero still didn't understand why they would be kidnapping and killing people. It didn't make any sense. And as much as she wanted it to, she knew she had to focus her energies elsewhere. Sal, and the people he was working with, needed to be stopped. When she got in her car and the Bluetooth synced with her phone, she pulled into the street and activated the speaker. There was no way they could risk using the police radio or their mobile data terminals. Sal had access to those, and she and Harvath didn't want to tip their hand. She called her commander and filled him in on everything as she raced toward the harbor. She then told him what they needed and reminded him again to keep everything off the police network. They absolutely had to assume that Sal was listening. Harvath listened to the conversation, and no sooner had she disconnected the call than his phone rang. It was Bill Wise. He was calling on his cell phone, rather than his blocked landline from D.C.
"Bill," he said, answering the call, "it's not a very good time right now."
"We've got a positive ID on the killer. He's definitely from Swim Club. His name is Salvatore
Sabatini," Harvath said, finishing the man's sentence for him. "I know. We just left his house."
"How did you—"
He cut him off again.
"It's a long story. Listen, where are you? Carlton said you were on your way up here to help us catch these guys."
"We're here now, and we've already caught one of them."
Harvath looked at Cordero and said,
"They've already caught one of them."
Turning his attention back to his phone, he said,
"Bill, I'm putting you on speaker with me and Boston PD Detective Lara Cordero. She was Sabatini's partner. You can trust her."
"Who did you capture?" Cordero asked, as Harvath pressed the button and held the phone out between them.
"A CIA operative named Stark," said Wise. "We've been interrogating him, and apparently there are two more operatives with him in Boston somewhere. A man named Vaccaro, and another, the team leader named Tom Cushing."
"I've got news for you, Bill,"
Harvath interjected, as he reflected on the model plane in Marco's room. It was the same model he'd been given after his first flight on the Fed's Ariane SBJ.
"I don't think these guys are working against the Federal Reserve. I think they're working for them."
"You're right, and wait till you hear why. Someone at the CIA named Phil Durkin put all of this together with the previous Federal Reserve chairman."
"Chairman Sawyer? The one who just died?"
"Yes," Wise replied. "It's a long story, but the Saudis blackmailed Sawyer into doing something for them. The only way Sawyer could pull it off was to hire Durkin for the job. Durkin agreed, but only as long as Sawyer would fund several of his black ops projects. It worked until Sawyer started having second thoughts and, with his tenure at the Fed coming to a close, crafted a list of potential replacements he thought might be able to make things right."
"Which was the last thing Durkin probably wanted, if making things right meant he was going to get his funding cut off."
"Exactly. And before he could get his own candidate installed as the new Fed chair, he needed to get rid of the five others who were actively being considered."
"Where are you?" Harvath asked.
"We've got Stark at a hotel near the harbor."
"That's where we think Sabatini is. We're headed there now."
"Scott, you've got to hurry," Wise insisted. "Stark says they have the last hostage, and they're going to kill him. Now."
Chapter 66. When Cordero's vehicle screamed to a stop at the edge of the harbor in full lights and sirens mode, the head of the Boston PD's rescue recovery dive team rushed up from the dock to meet them.
"The rest of the team is inbound," the man said. 5 minutes, we'll be on the water."
"We don't have 5 minutes, Sergeant," Harvath replied. "We have to get going, now. Where's your boat?"
The dive team commander led Harvath and Cordero down a gangplank to a 30-foot-long rigid inflatable boat that belonged to the Boston Fire Department. A bunch of dive gear was already loaded on board. It would have to do. Spinning his finger in the air, he gave the boat's pilot the signal to get the craft's twin 225-horsepower Evinrude E-Tech engines fired up. As the sergeant untied the boat, Harvath helped Cordero on board, stepped into the pilot house, and told the man captaining the vessel what they were looking for. He also reasserted that they were to maintain strict radio silence, as the men they were chasing had access to police communications. 30 seconds later, they were away from the dock and roaring into Boston Harbor. The dive team leader unpacked two scopes, one thermal, the other night vision, and offered Harvath his choice. Harvath took the night vision device, and both men moved forward as the boat slammed through the water. There was a ton of traffic in the harbor. Any one of the boats they were seeing could be the one they were looking for. The CIA man whom Wise had been interrogating supposedly had no idea what the boat's name was or what kind it was. He was never intended to be part of what was happening in the harbor. His job had been to prep Betsy Mitchell to look and sound like a mentally disturbed homeless person, track her progress via the remote camera she'd been outfitted with, and get her to the site of the Boston Massacre and remotely detonate the suicide vest she had been forced to wear. When Harvath asked how Wise had been so successful in getting so much information out of the man so quickly, he explained that it had been Reed Carlton's idea. Apparently, the old man had his own swim club assassin in custody back in D.C. The man's name was Samuel. Carlton had Samuel driven to Stark's home, and then a phone call was placed. When Samuel got done describing the exterior of Stark's home and what he could see his family doing inside, Stark had completely caved and told them everything. Harvath's mind was still reeling from what Wise had told him about the former Fed chairman being blackmailed by the Saudis. When he asked how Sawyer had ever crossed paths with Durkin, Wise explained that the relationship had been facilitated through the chairman's security chief, William Jacobson. What bothered Harvath the most was the way it all fit together. How much sense it made. Actually, that wasn't what bothered him the most. What bothered him the most was that by doing the right thing, he might end up actually hastening his own country's collapse. There had to be a way around it. There had to be a way to prevent it all from happening and using their own plan against them. If there was, it wasn't coming to mind at the moment, which was just as well, because through the night vision scope, he picked up something floating off their starboard bow, 100 meters out. He quickly relayed the information to the crewman in the pilot house, who adjusted course and headed right for it. Harvath handed the night vision scope to the sergeant, told him to relay the information on the vessel that was speeding away, and then rushed to the back of the boat where Cordero was. "What are you doing?" she said, as she watched him rapidly get undressed.
"They've already dumped the body."
The sergeant, upon seeing what Harvath was doing, yelled, "Hey, you can't do that! You're not qualified!" He already had the weight belt around his waist, had tested the regulator, and had swung the tank onto his back. He lowered the mask over his face and grabbed a knife and flashlight just as the fire department boat coasted to a stop. A large wooden box, made to look like a crate of British tea, was bobbing on the surface. As Harvath switched on his light and went over the side into the water, the last thing he noticed was the skull, bones, and crown that had been painted on its side. The water was cold, but Harvath had been in much worse and didn't pay any attention. It was also dark. There was no light at all except for the beam from his underwater flashlight. The crate on the surface was meant as a marker, and he followed the rope attached to it deeper and deeper into the water. There were no air bubbles rising up to meet the beam of his flashlight. All he could think was,
"Please, don't let Jonathan Renner be dead. Let us have at least saved one of the victims."
Soon thereafter, a form began to take shape at the end of the line. As he got closer, he saw it was some sort of bag or a sack made of canvas, and big enough to hold a body and be weighted down with rocks or cannonballs, as was historically seen with burials at sea. Harvath reached out and touched the bag. He could feel Renner inside it. Placing the tip of his knife at the top of the canvas, he plunged the blade through and ripped open the biggest hole he could. He saw the man's hair in the beam of flashlight and pulled furiously at the fabric until he could access his face. Removing the regulator from his mouth, he moved it toward the man and hit the purge button, preparing to deliver life-saving air. That's when he noticed two things: that the man was dead, and that he was also not Jonathan Renner. Chapter 67. Bill Wise had no intention of leaving Stark alone in the hotel room. Ryan and McGee, though, wanted to be part of taking down Cushing and his people, so Wise had asked Harvath to take them along. Harvath had agreed, provided they made it to the dock by the time he got there. He had been crystal clear that he wouldn't wait for them, and he didn't. He and Cordero had hopped onto the Boston FD boat and taken off immediately. Ryan and McGee got there just in time to see the boat speeding away into the harbor. They weren't the only ones left behind. Several members of the dive team showed up minutes later and were without a boat. Maintaining their operation security, one of the divers got on his phone and made a call. Minutes later, a Boston PD Harbor Patrol boat raced up to the dock. The divers loaded their gear and sped back out after their teammates. By the time they caught up with the 30-foot Boston FD boat, Harvath had just surfaced. As the Harbor Patrol boat pulled up alongside, they shined a powerful spotlight on him.
"It's not Renner," he yelled, after removing his regulator. "It's somebody else. Shot point blank."
Climbing back into the boat, he told Cordero and the dive team leader what he had seen. The sergeant barked a series of rapid orders, and once they had cleared off the Harbor Patrol boat, Harvath and Cordero hopped on. They introduced themselves quickly to Ryan and McGee. Cordero flashed her credentials to the two Boston PD officers operating the boat and told them the last known direction of the vessel they needed to catch.
"It's all over the radio now," one of the men said.
"There's not supposed to be any radio traffic."
"The way these guys were moving through the harbor, they caught the Coast Guard's attention. They're now in pursuit. If you'll sit down and hold on, we'll see if we can get you close. Sounds like they're going to cross our path about a mile from here."
Cordero nodded. Everyone held on, and the Harbor Patrol officers threw the throttles all the way forward. Their boat was even faster than the fire department's, and it sliced through the choppy harbor. Cordero leaned in close, so Harvath could hear her above the roar of the engines and the wind rushing by them.
"If it wasn't Renner's," she said, "whose body did you find down there?"
"I have no idea," Harvath said, "but I have a feeling Sal made good on his promise."
"What promise was that?"
Ryan yelled.
"Sabatini said he didn't have anything to do with the bombing tonight. Said it made him angry. He claimed he was going to settle up with who was responsible."
"Fat chance of that," McGee replied. "The guy responsible is cinched up back at the hotel with an MP5 pointed at his chest."
"Then who's bouncing along the bottom of the Boston Harbor right now?"
Ryan had an idea and was about to respond when a deafening roar overtook them like a tidal wave from behind. They all spun at once to see a giant Sikorsky MH-60T Coast Guard Jayhawk helicopter race right above them, headed in the same direction.
"They've already got eyes on the target,"
one of the Harbor Patrol officers shouted from the pilot house.
"Suspect is wearing a Boston PD raid jacket."
Ryan got Harvath's attention and yelled over the engines,
"Sabatini?"
Harvath nodded. When the large ocean-going cabin cruiser came into view, they counted five other boats in hot pursuit, three from the Boston PD and two from the U.S. Coast Guard, all of which were keeping it lit up with their spotlights. Up on the flybridge, Harvath could just make out Sal's Boston PD jacket. The Sikorsky banked to come around, and Harvath saw that its door was open and its interior blacked out. The Coast Guard didn't goof around, and that door hadn't been left open for the breeze. Though he couldn't see him, Harvath knew there was a sniper in there. As soon as the helicopter was in place, another round of commands were issued over one of the Coast Guard vessel's PA systems for the driver of the cabin cruiser to bring his boat to a full and immediate halt. When the cabin cruiser didn't respond, two ear-splitting cracks that sounded like thunder erupted from the Sikorsky, and two heavy 50-caliber rounds were loosed to pierce the boat's engine blocks. Within seconds, smoke began to billow from the stern, and the boat lost power. It eventually came to an eerie stop and just bobbed up and down on the water. No matter how many commands were given over the PA system to the man on the flybridge, he refused to move. The boarding teams on their respective vessels made ready, while the helicopter with its sniper hovered nearby. McGee tapped one of the harbor patrolmen on the shoulder and said, "Make sure they know that in addition to the rogue Boston PD detective, we believe there are two accomplices and a hostage on board. The accomplices are very well trained and will be well armed." The officer nodded and relayed the information to the other units. For Harvath, Cordero, Ryan, and McGee, it was now a waiting game. The Coast Guard relayed one last series of instructions to the man on the flybridge, and when he didn't respond, the boarding teams were given the green light to launch their assault. As Harvath watched the teams work, something out of place at the stern caught his eye. Suddenly, there was activity over the radio, which the harbor patrol officers had turned up the volume on so that Cordero and everyone else could listen in on what was happening. The man on the flybridge was dead.
"Dead?" Cordero repeated. "How the hell is that possible?"
The patrolman started to shrug when another message was received. The boarding team had located a survivor. The rest of the vessel was clear. Harvath stepped into the pilot house and said to the co-pilot,
"Radio the Coast Guard that we're coming aboard."
To the officer piloting the boat, he said,
"Bring us alongside, now."
When it was explained that Cordero was not only Boston PD, but the partner of the rogue cop, they were granted permission to board. The first person they saw was the survivor, Jonathan Renner. He was sitting in the boat's salon, wrapped in a blanket. Harvath approached the man and asked,
"Mr. Renner?"
The man looked up and nodded.
"I'm very glad to see you alive, sir. We're going to get you back to shore and to your family as quickly as possible, okay?"
Renner nodded again, and Harvath walked out of the salon and back onto the deck. Climbing up to the flybridge, he joined Cordero, along with Ryan and McGee, who were already there.
"It's not Sal," the female detective said. "Who is it, then?" he asked.
"Tom Cushing," Ryan replied. "Whoever killed him," said McGee, "used fishing line to keep him in a seated position. The boat has an autopilot." Harvath studied all the blood pooled in the man's lap and running down his legs.
"Somebody gut shot him. Not many more painful ways to go than that."
"I think we can make an educated guess as to who pulled the trigger," Cordero stated.
"And with Renner safe downstairs, I think we can also make a pretty well-educated guess who I found underwater."
"Ficarro,"
said Ryan.
Harvath nodded. "Then where's Sabatini?"
Harvath led the group down the stairs to the stern of the cabin cruiser. Two of the Coast Guardsmen had already vented the engine compartment and made sure there was no threat of fire. Leaning over the back of the boat, he pointed at the swim platform, where two nylon tie-down straps were dangling.
"How much do you want to bet that until just a little while ago, there used to be a wave runner or a jet ski there?"
Ryan looked at McGee.
"We need to warn Wise."
The knock on the hotel door was loud and unsettling. In fact, it wasn't even a knock. It was a pounding.
"Boston police, open up," the voice commanded. "Police, open the door."
Not only did Bill Wise have a prisoner secured to a chair and gagged, but the room was also awash in Class 3 weapons and other assorted items like tasers and recording devices. Without credentials, there was no way he'd be able to explain his way out of this. Police involvement was something they absolutely didn't need. What they needed was to get Stark to D.C. as quickly and as quietly as possible, so he could tell his story there. That step, though, was now suddenly in jeopardy. One of the guests, or hotel security, must have seen or heard something. As he approached the door, his cell phone back on the desk began ringing, and another thought suddenly gripped him.
"Police!" the voice shouted,
as the pounding recommenced.
Open up!
Bill Wise raised his MP5 ready to fire, just as the door was kicked in from the outside. He stumbled backward and landed on his ass in the bathroom. A fraction of a second later, something was tossed into the room and was followed by a blindingly bright light and an overpowering explosion. Chapter 68. Ryan's cell phone rang just before the Harbor Patrol unit boat reached the dock.
"It's Wise," she exclaimed as she activated the call. "Bill, we've been trying to reach you. We think Sabatini may be on his way to you."
Wise interrupted her, and she listened as he relayed what happened. She then told him to hold on while she shared it with the others.
"Bill's okay, but Stark's dead. Sabatini pitched a flashbang into the hotel room, and while Bill was down, he put a round into each of Stark's kneecaps and then a round through the base of his throat. There was nothing Bill could do for him. Bill says it was pretty obvious that Sabatini wanted Stark to die as painful a death as possible."
"Where's Bill now?" Harvath asked.
Ryan asked him, and then replied, "He sanitized the room as quickly as he could, and barely made it out of the hotel. He's about 4 blocks away now. Says there are police cars everywhere."
McGee, who had been listening to the radio, nodded. "Boston PD has confirmed a gunshot fatality at the Renaissance." Harvath looked at Cordero.
"Anyone answering?"
As Ryan's call had come in, Cordero had checked her own phone. She had missed a call from home. This was the second time she had tried calling back. Pulling the cell phone away from her ear, she shook her head.
"That's not like them. My parents always pick up."
Whether it was the mother in her or the detective, she decided to call her tenants in the downstairs apartment just to make sure everything was okay. As the boat pulled up to the dock, Harvath addressed Ryan and McGee.
"You know where the rally point is, so pick Wise up or have him meet you there, but hurry."
Hopping out onto the dock, he offered his hand to Cordero and helped her out of the boat. No sooner had her feet touched the pier than all the color drained from her face.
"What is it?"
Harvath asked.
"One of the neighbors saw Sal going into my building. We need to get back there. Now!" she ordered.
They both took off running and found her car right where she had left it. Leaping in, they made as much noise leaving the harbor as they had when they had arrived. In any other city, Harvath would have wanted to be the one doing the driving, but with Boston's nightmare of one-way streets, he was glad to have her behind the wheel. As they entered her neighborhood, she killed the siren, but kept the wigwags flashing. Then, a block before her home, she killed those too. The gradual falling away of her mental armor and police persona that Harvath had so admired earlier in the evening wasn't happening this time. There'd be no stand-down until she knew her family was safe. They parked around the corner, and Cordero laid out how she wanted to handle it.
"Promise me," she insisted.
Harvath didn't like what she was proposing. Sal Sabatini was a killer. It didn't matter how many years they had worked together.
"Promise me," she repeated.
There was no way he was going to talk her out of it. She had made up her mind. Reluctantly, he agreed and gave her his word. Standing there as she walked away, he was certain that they had both just made the biggest mistake of their lives. Opening the downstairs door, Cordero crept up to her second-floor apartment as quietly as she could. The stairs were over 100 years old, and even in places you thought were safe to put your weight, they still creaked. It was almost as bad as having a little dog yapping the alarm that someone was coming. Not that it mattered, because when she reached the landing, she saw that her front door was wide open and knew that Sal Sabatini was already waiting for her. Stepping into her apartment, she saw her mother first, tears rolling down her cheeks. Next to her was her father, his face a mixture of fear and anger. Finally, as she stepped all the way inside, she saw Sal holding them at gunpoint.
"Please close the door behind you," he said.
Cordero did as she was told.
"Good. Now please, slowly, remove both of your weapons and slide them across the floor to me."
"Where's Marco?"
she asked, as she slid both of the guns to him. sliding the weapons into the new jacket he was wearing, he replied, "He's safe."
"Where is he, Sal? Tell me."
"He's in his room, asleep. You don't have to worry."
"Why did you come here?"
"I wanted to tell you that I took care of everything."
"Meaning what? That you killed those men?"
she said.
"Cushing, Vaccaro, Stark? Along with all the other people you've killed? That's why you came here?"
Sabatini held his finger to his lips.
"Shh! Be quiet! You don't want to wake Marco." "Sal, this needs to end. You're sick. You need help."
The man smiled at her. "It is going to end. Trust me. By the way, where's your new partner?"
"I don't have a new partner, Sal. You're my partner."
The killer's smile faded, replaced by anger.
"What do you think I am, stupid? You don't think I see how he looks at you?" "Sal, he doesn't..."
"Shut up!" he roared. "Shut up!"
"Sal, I want you to get help."
"I don't need any help. I help you. Remember? When your husband died?"
"I remember, Sal. You helped us a lot."
"You don't remember shit. All you care about is yourself, you selfish bitch."
Cordero's father attempted to stand, but Sabatini shoved him back down. The female detective tried to de-escalate things and spoke calmly to her father in Portuguese.
"That's right," Sabatini sneered. "You tell him that if he does that again, he's a dead man."
Cordero said a few more words and then turned back to the killer.
"Sal, if you came to say goodbye, let's say goodbye. Please, before anyone gets hurt."
His face went from enraged to an odd smile.
"I didn't come to say goodbye. I came to take you with me." "I'm sorry, Sal. My place is here, with my son."
"Marco will be with us."
The way he said it sent shivers down her spine.
"I'm not going to hurt anyone. I'm done hurting people. I'm done hurting myself. No one is going to feel any pain anymore."
"Sal, please," she began,
hoping she could talk him into laying down his weapon and not harming anyone else.
"Fuck, please," he shouted. "I'm the lion. You don't tell the lion what to do. Not now, not ever. You do what I say when I say it. You obey me. Do you understand me?"
Cordero nodded. The man was coming completely unspooled.
"Now, where's your fucking boyfriend? And don't you lie to me."
"I don't have a boyfriend, Sal."
"Liar!"
he screamed, reaching out with his free hand and striking her across the face. Cordero's father leapt up to challenge him, and Sabatini struck him across the side of his face with his pistol. The older man's knees buckled, and he fell back onto the couch. Cordero spoke to him rapidly in Portuguese once more, and then turned her attention to the killer.
"Sal, stop this."
"Sal, stop this," he replied, mocking her. "No more games. It's time to go."
Grabbing her by the hair, he pulled her head down so she had to walk with it sideways. Looking at her angry father and terrified mother, Sabatini said,
"If you move, everyone dies. The boy dies. Do you understand?"
Cordero spoke again in Portuguese to her parents, who sat frozen in place on the couch, and they nodded. Sabatini smiled.
"Good. Let's move," he commanded,
as he dragged her over to the base station for her cordless phone, ripped it out of the wall, and then dragged her down the hall toward Marco's room.
"Sal, you don't have to do..."
"Shh,"
he whispered, cutting her off.
"It's all going to be very quiet, very soon. You'll see. We're going to be happy."
They reached Marco's room, and Sabatini used the toe of his boot to push the door open. He looked down into the bed, but the little boy was gone. Sabatini flipped right back into rage mode.
"Where is he?" he shouted. "Where the fuck is he?"
Cordero didn't reply. Pulling her with him, he stepped into the room and flipped over the race car bed. He then threw open the closet doors, but the little boy wasn't there either.
He then dragged Cordero back down the hall and threw her like a piece of trash onto the living room floor. He pointed his weapon at her and was about to threaten to kill her in order to get her parents to tell him where the little boy was hiding, when he noticed her parents were gone too.
"What the fuck is going on here?" he screamed. "Where the fuck are they?"
"Out stealing me a new sailboat, asshole,"
said a voice from behind. Before Sabatini could even react, Harvath depressed his trigger twice, the shots perfectly aimed and placed exactly where the killer deserved them.
Chapter 69 Tierra del Fuego, 5 days later. With its money and powerful reach, the Federal Reserve, or more precisely, Monroe Lewis, acting under the auspices of the Federal Reserve, was able to make the impossible possible, including establishing phony flight plans for its Ariane supersonic business jet. As Reed Carlton, Lydia Ryan, and Bob McGee huddled with General George Johnson and his team at the Directorate of National Intelligence, Harvath had been able to cut through all the red tape and trace the plane with one phone call.
"Buenos Aires," said Natalie, the Swedish flight attendant. "Additional passengers boarded. We flew further south to Tierra del Fuego, and then everyone disembarked when we landed at the airport at Ushuaia."
Harvath thanked her and gave the information to Johnson's people. Within an hour, they had CCTV footage from our